This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision. He's now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Matt Martinson. Matt is the one-man sound army behind Vancouver's very own Clay Entertainment. Matt is the mastermind behind the many sounds of Clay's hit game, Don't Starve. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
So we're really excited to have Matt on today for our topic, which is sound design and audio effects, especially in indie games, because that's what Matt works on and often who the folks we're talking to are in the indie game world. And just sort of kind of dig through sort of what makes, you know, what is the job of a sound designer? What are some of the tools and trade-offs that you're working on sound design, especially in the indie world? So I figured I would start by kind of kicking off to Matt, because the way that I would originally invited Matt on the show is because I saw his full indie talk here in Vancouver, which was very excellent, by the way.
Thank you.
And so I wanted to give you a chance to say kind of what that talk was about, even though it was a bit of a kind of exploring around what that talk was about that you gave.
Sure. I did a talk on The Sounds of Don't Starve, which is one of our last big games at Clay Entertainment. And it was just generally everything involved in the sound that went into that game. I tried to touch on just a little bit of everything. So we touched on the tools and how I made certain sounds, different stories that had come up while making the sounds of the game. And so it was trying to make it to not super sound focused in a way so that people that weren't sound designers could get something out of it.
Which I think really succeeded because you know, my sound design credentials are about equivalent to I made a rocket sound out of noise for my hobby game last weekend, and it was just and that's about my sound design expertise. But I was quite fascinated with your talk, and so I'll touch on a couple of the things that were in it. But one of the things that I thought was interesting was particularly interesting, and I generally would say, and I think you might have said this as well in the talk, that most of the time you don't want to consciously notice sound design. You want it to sort of enhance like a salt kind of in a dish rather than...
I think that's probably a good analogy there. It's if you come away from, to me, if you come away from a game going, hey, that game sounded great, then something went wrong.
Right.
And be it the sound or design or something, you shouldn't notice it. You should just walk away going, that was a great game. And, you know, to me, if audio is doing its job right, that's what's going to happen. When audio does its job bad, that's when you're like, wow, that game sounded really bad.
Right.
It starts to poke out at you. It should blend in. I've got this kind of philosophy that if you're doing sound, you're either doing one of two things. You're either world building, you know, creating an immersion for the player to be in, or you're informing the player of something. You know, be it a HUD sound, like a gunfire is informing the player of something. It's informing the player you are shooting a gun. And then when it, you know, clicks empty, it's your gun is empty. So everything else should be informing the player of something. And those should also not quite be conscious sounds of like, you know, I knew I had to reload my gun.
It's really easy for indie games to be like, oh, well, you know, sound isn't that important. And you can get away with less world building if your game isn't incredibly narrative. But it's frustrating when I've played games where you will do something that you expect to have an effect, like, you know, press a button or whatever, and then there's no real sound. And you're like, oh, okay, well, I'll assume that this was not the lever that opened the big iron door or something because I didn't hear anything. Whereas, no, it just didn't have a sound effect for that.
Really good example, like the opposite of that, sort of, is Limbo. The very first puzzle in Limbo, you flick a switch and nothing happens on screen. But if you travel back a screen, a trap will have fallen out of a tree. Now, there is a sound cue for that, so you have to be listening to it. If you're not listening for the entire world, then you miss it and you're like, I don't know what to do. I give them a lot of credit for making a sound only, you know, informational thing that if you're not listening, you're missing stuff in that game, which is really great.
Yeah, and that goes back to, or at least when I think of that as like Zelda, even like Zelda 64, you would always be pushing knobs and switches and stepping on things, and it would go, and it would play the little music, like,
yeah,
you did
like,
a thing.
Something happened. Okay, that did something.
Yeah.
It always bugs me, and unfortunately, it's a lot in indie games when menus don't have sounds, just simple up and down clicks and clicks forward and back. When those are missing, I start to wonder what else is missing in this game. If you haven't gotten your menu sounds right, then to me, there's a sign that the rest of the audio might be a problem.
It's a very similar thing to, skeuomorphism in visual UIs of like, why does a button kind of feel more satisfying if it looks like there's a little shadow on it and it feels like it depresses when you press it? And it sounds kind of the same thing, right? When you're dealing with those things in real life, they make noises. Like if you go and press an actual button in real life, there's going to be a little click of the mechanism moving. And so in, sound gives it that sense of it being a more physically real thing that you're interacting with. And I think it lets you get away from having to do some of that artificially, right? That it, because sound is a natural part of the world. Like if there's, if you're in a dungeon and there's a pressure plate that's going to open some door and you step on it, it makes a little noise. You don't have to have a, like an obvious, like, oh, this thing starts glowing when I, when I do this, or there's a big camera movement that shows me the thing that opens it. That feels more like a natural part of the world, whereas doing those things, I mean, obviously there's ways to do those things visually that don't have that problem. If you're already looking at the thing that's that opens, then it's not going to be it's not gonna be as unnatural. But I think sound gives you a really nice natural way to do that, because you don't have to disrupt the rest of the visual flow in order to do it.
Which brings up to me an interesting point too, that you're talking about the physical aspects of like a switch or something. In real life, you get a tactile feedback that you've pressed something, like it moves as well as making a sound. So in a video game, we don't have that physical connection to anything. So the sound replaces that. Like, so if the sound isn't there, then you're missing any kind of tactileness to your buttons.
Yeah, I had never thought about that effect, actually. So when you're trying to give feedback, obviously the informational part of the sounds are the more sort of crucial part, sort of half of those two things as far as actually being able to play the game. How much do you find, we can use Starve as an example, or any other game that you are maybe working on now or have worked on in the past. How much do you find that that's an iterative process where people are playtesting the game fairly late and then they're coming to you and they're like, ah, Matt, we don't have a sound for this thing, and people don't realize that, when they drop it, that it's broken or something. It just goes on the ground and a broken animation happens, but they didn't notice that it broke.
Yeah, I think I've been doing this long enough. I've been doing game sound for 11 years. So I feel like most of the time I can see what in a design, like what it's going to need. So usually I catch those things, but when a new animation is going in and they're like, they show me the animation, I'm like, okay, this is where we need sounds in there. Or this is a new menu goes in, I'm like, this is where we need sounds for it. So usually I catch those things. It's more iterative in what sound is right for that event. And a lot of times if art changes, the sound needs to change as well. And sometimes it's a mix change. We had comments in Don't Starve that the pickup sound, a bunch of people didn't like the pickup sound when we were in early access. There's a real dink when you pick something up. So there was in the forums, people were complaining about that they didn't like the sound, that they wanted to change it. In fact, some of them wanted to be able to turn just that sound off. They wanted a menu option for just that sound.
That's a sign that you just need to change the sound, probably.
So I talked to the designers and other people on the team. I'm like, okay, we're getting a lot of negative feedback about the sound. What do you guys think? I still think it's right. And I talked to the designers, and they're like, you know what? We think it's right, too. And so I'm like, okay. And I went back and played the game, and I'm like, you know what? It's just too loud. If I turn this down, then it's great. It's currently too loud. And that's what was getting to a lot of people. And people who aren't audio people sometimes don't know what it is about something that they don't like. Like something is bothering them about the sound, and they don't know if it's too loud or too quiet or needs to be different or what. So sometimes it may just be that your sound isn't mixed right, not that it's the wrong sound.
So that pickup sound, for anyone who hasn't played Don't Starve, you pick things up very frequently in that game. So you hear that sound a lot.
Yes.
Is it always exactly the same sound every time, or is there like, you know, two pickup sounds that
there is exactly one pickup sound
right
for all of that. And that goes into the, like, sort of when should you have variety and when shouldn't you have variety? To me, something like that pickup sound is, it is doing the same thing every time. So it should have the exact same sound because you want to reinforce you have done this exact thing. You have picked something up. When you start to introduce variety, then people start to question what they've done. But whereas a footsteps should have a lot of variety because it is different every time you naturally step in the world.
Right. So there's a couple of types of variety on something like footsteps. Obviously, as you step on different types of terrain, then you're going to want to get different types of sounds, which we could talk about that as well. But
yep.
My understanding is that there's a certain amount of like software randomization that certain games do in order
yes.
to have one effect played
any
repeatedly.
Any good game will have either through their own audio engine or a middleware engine be doing variety on those things. It's the way you turn a little into a lot. A AAA game will possibly have like 20 footsteps for a given surface, for a given type of step. I found that on a really budget, like tight game, you can get away with 4 if you're doing pitch shifting and volume randomizations on them as well.
So is that like you're creating a script in the audio system where it says, okay, vary the pitch each time by some random amount in between this amount, vary the volume by in between this amount and this amount, and you go? Or is it a little more subtle than that?
No, it's basically that. I'm used to using middleware these days, so FMOD or Wise or Fabric, and those have that functionality built into them. So it's just like I set up an event and I tick a box that says and set how much I want the randomization to go.
Sounds great. Let's get that. So there's a couple of pieces of middleware. You mentioned FMOD briefly in your talk.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about, I guess there's multiple questions. What does it do maybe to start? And then maybe we could talk a little later about the different options as far as there's multiple middleware packages and then how that actually goes into making the game.
I feel the big ones right now, I'll just touch on that really quickly. The big ones these days are FMOD, Wise with 2 W's, and Fabric if you're doing Unity only. So what those do, all the middleware does is it gives a design tool for a sound designer to interface with the audio in a game. So instead of having a sound designer make a sound and go to a programmer, okay, this is a sound or a collection of sound. This is my 5 sounds. I want them all to fire on one event, and I want them to randomize by these percentages, and they should be at this volume and this panning. Make that all happen in code. And that doing that every time you have an event for anything, you go, here is the event. Call this event, and the middleware will do all the things that I, as a sound designer, want them to do, and the coder doesn't need to know about any of it.
Right.
That's essentially what it does.
So it's in some ways like a sort of a scripting and basically what a level designer might have for tools. It's what the sound designer has for tools.
Yeah, it's an audio engine. So on a root level, it, you know, is an API for running all your sound, and then has a design tool on top of that lets somebody who is not a coder, who doesn't know code, to interface with the audio.
Right. So how, you know, how did these things, the options, so we got FMOD, you got Wise, you got Fabric. You mentioned Fabric is more for if you're doing Unity games.
It is a Unity plugin.
Right.
So it is only, and I believe they do web now as well. So it's a little bit smaller. The FMOD and Wise generate for pretty much everything. Interestingly enough, except for web. Fabric is the only one who does web. So
right. And FMOD and Wise, are those like sort of like C++ live? Maybe you don't know the programming besides.
I believe the APIs are, yeah, like a C++ type library.
Thing, and
like,
you just drop
it's an API that you drop into the game. So that's the extent of my knowledge on that part.
Is that mostly the same in the AAA world, as you know, Nigel? It's like basically the sound designers have some library that you either have licensed or build yourself that allows them to configure those things?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, AAA use I think some of the same libraries in some cases, or a lot of the big game engines have stuff like that built in, like Unreal. I believe the regular scripting system is sort of rich enough to do that kind of audio scripting. I think audio is probably something that people are a little more likely to roll their own than some of the other areas as well. You know, we talked before about how physics systems are always licensed these days because, physics has a bunch of really complicated domain-specific knowledge and math that's beyond the reach of most people that are writing games. Whereas audio, I think, tends towards the other end, that audio from a programming standpoint is fairly simple to deal with compared to some of the other resources that you've got in games, that a lot of the stuff that's important about audio is on the artistic side of things, of what sound effects are you using, you know, when are you playing them, how are you layering them, and there's not as much complexity that goes into how do you process the audio data? The audio data is a pretty simple, like, you know, you've got a stream of bits and you've got some DSP function that you're going to run over it to achieve certain effects, and you have a couple of tracks that you mix together. And so, it's something that in the AAA world, I think you're more likely to just say, well, we'll roll our own rather than licensing something, because it's not as big an undertaking as a physics engine or a graphics engine. But you definitely need to, you need to give the sound designers those tools. As Matt said, the worst situation in any game art or content, be it sound, be it graphics, whatever, is to get in a situation where the artists that are making it can't tune things without programmer involvement. And so you always got to make sure that there's a set of tools where the artist can set up animation or sound or whatever in a way that doesn't require writing code. And that's sort of the crucial part of it.
Even as just a coder, like I keep mentioning this little hobby space game I'm making just for fun, and I was like, okay, I should have this thruster sound, and I should turn the thruster sound on, and then when you stop thrusting, it should turn off. But that sounded horrible because it doesn't fade in or fade out or whatever. And yeah, so I start wanting to, like,
you need a start sound, you need a stop sound. You should probably have the thruster. If it's an on-off, it should be okay as a loop, but if it revs up and down, you might want to tie it into pitching up and down as it goes, more like an engine in a car does the sound for. So, yeah, there's a lot more than turning it on and off.
Yeah, I learned that. It sounds terrible. And, like, I figured my dumb sound effect would be the problem, but it was actually, like, the starting and the stopping and then sort of getting it to seamlessly go into the world, which is a challenge. So, I don't know, maybe I should download FMod and put it into my game that's got, like, 100 lines of code, and FMod has 100,000 lines of code, just so I can...
Well, I don't know that FMod helps much if you are a programmer. Like, that's back to that issue that I said of its sound doesn't have the same problem that rendering does, for example, where there's a huge amount of domain specific knowledge just to get that first thing playing. Like, your problem with that sound effect is not that it's hard for you to script things, it's that it's hard for you to build the sound effects that link together, right? Like, once you've got a reasonable start sound and a reasonable looping thrust sound and a reasonable end sound, stitching them together in code, if you're a programmer, is not complicated. The part that is difficult is building those sounds in a way that it flows together and sounds good. And that's the skill of the sound designer, is making sure that all of those little pieces of sound that you're going to stitch together to make a whole effect work together well, and that different effects play off each other well and don't sound like they're from different games and stuff like that.
Yeah. The other thing that middleware does is saves time. I worked on an indie game with Alex from Full Indie, Infested Planet, and he rolled his own audio engine in that. And he asked me, like, what are all the things you need to do to, make this game sound decent? And I gave him a list of different variations I needed and containers. And once he was done, he looked at how long he spent making that audio engine and what it costs to license FMod. And he was like, I should have just done FMod. You know, we generally take half a day for a programmer to get one of these audio engines into our games at Clay, you know, and then it's done. And it took him, Alex, days, if not weeks, to program an audio engine. So that's the other thing on the programmer side. It saves time.
Yeah, to be clear, when I was talking about it's more justifiable to roll your own, I was thinking more of at the AAA level where at the sound end is a small enough part of it that it tends to sort of fall away. At the indie level, yeah, absolutely, you should.
And also at the AAA level, a lot of times you're doing stuff that can't be accounted for in any middleware. Like, I don't know a single sports game that doesn't roll its own speech system because nobody's making a middleware system that handles speech in the way a sports game needs to handle that. You know, it's such an esoteric thing. So there's all instances like that as well.
Speaking of speech.
Yes.
What are the... So voice acting obviously is something that can be really great when it's great and can be bad.
It's really horrible if it's horrible.
So maybe like there's lots of things we can talk about, but like what are the trade-offs when you're thinking about like should I have voice acting in this game or not? I mean, obviously at a game design, it's nice to have fully amazing voice acting for every single character, but you were saying in Don't Starve that you wanted to try to avoid that.
We couldn't do speech in that game. It would have been impossible. It would have been cost so much money and tied so many people's hands when it came to design that it really would have been a major hindrance. Because we were doing 2-week updates and every 2 weeks, 20, 30, 40, 100 lines were going into the game that were getting written on the spot for, oh, I made a new object. Okay, I need to write a new line for each character talking about that object. To get people to come in every 2 weeks and record all those lines, it would have killed us.
And the speed that you want to be able to change things, you know, somebody says it's getting dark and they're going to die if they don't have a fire, and they just say, it's getting dark. And then you find the players don't react to that strongly enough and then they die. It'd be nice if we were like, uh-oh, it's getting dark. I should do something. Like, you know, you can make it more urgent or update or improve those things very quickly.
The way speech has generally worked, like in AAA and most, you know, pre-early access games, you design your game, you write all your speech, you iterate on that, and then you record the speech and implement it at the very last second so that you're sure that you've got all of the lines, and maybe you have a pickup session after that where you put all of it into the game and you realize there's a couple of things you missed. So you get everybody back for one last session and grab everything and then put it in. So when you're doing an early access iterative game, that kind of can't happen because you can't iterate on the game truly without knowing the speech that's in it, how that's affecting the gameplay and interest and player engagement and everything. So it becomes much harder to do speech on a quick level like that, unless you have all your voice actors in-house. You know, if you're using team members who are good enough, then it can work. But it's still a big scheduling thing.
Which the games that have a lot, or my understanding is games that have a lot of voice acting will often do placeholder voice acting while they're waiting for everything to get dialed in. Like,
yeah, which is then a big time sink that you got to account for, that you're going to, I have to spend time getting all this temporary dialogue that I'm going to throw away. And you have to be comfortable with that.
Isn't that how you ended up in a game, Nigel?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't a temp track. I got cast.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. The two Radical mainly did like AAA kind of games. We did a couple of games with the CSI license that were sort of more like hidden object puzzly kind of games. And yeah, I did voices for one of those.
Why in the hell would I want to kill my own father? We were tight. We were best friends.
That we did there. And no, that it was one of those things where I was friends with one of the sound designers there, because I'd gotten him to help me out with doing some sound for a theater production that I was working on. And so he sort of knew that I was, you know, sort of one foot in that world as a hobby. And it was one of those things where they, you know, they had a character that was small enough. They didn't want to bring a pro in to do it, but they knew it was going to go out in the final game. And so they brought me in to do it.
That was how I ended up being one of the guards in Mark of the Ninja, was I was the temp voice, and I did it good enough that it stood up against the voice actors, so we used it because it was a free voice.
There's like probably the most famous example of that in film, which is Edna Mode in The Incredibles.
The costume designer.
It's voiced by Brad Bird, the director.
No, but like Edna, she's the one who does
she's the costume designer. And yep. So he recorded that as a temp track, and then they were like looking for a real actor to record it at some point, and some reasonably well-known actress, like famous actress they'd gotten in. I wish I could remember who it is. We'll have to find the story and put it in the show notes. But they brought her in and they're like, okay, you're going to record this voice and here's the temp track. And she was like, you guys are crazy. You've already got the thing. Like, why am I even here? Just use this temp track. And so they did. That's, in the final cut of The Incredibles, it's Brad Bird voicing Edna Mode.
Nice. That's awesome. That's, it brings up to like the reason you should do really good quality voice tracks is because of that. It might be able to end up being in your game. If the temp track is good enough, why not use it? But that means you have to record it at a quality and professional level at the very beginning, which I think is really important so that you can truly judge whether it's going to work or not. If you're putting in speech, like on Mark of the Ninja, we put in way more speech than ended up in the game because we were like, what could everything that the guard's maybe going to say? Let's just record all those lines and see what works and see what doesn't and see where there's holes, and fill it out from there. And so we found a bunch of lines that we didn't need. But I recorded all of them and I recorded them at a high enough level that was like, we can judge this as if it was a real thing, not, okay, pretend that it sounds better and listen to it, which I think a lot of temp stuff does.
So that being said, doing all that speech, especially for a game like Don't Starve, where it doesn't, there's always new stuff coming into the game and there's an almost infinite number of interactions of things that people might want to say, various things. You went a different route and I think it came off with something very fun and cool.
We sure did. Me and Jeff, our creative director, sat down and we're like trying to think of, okay, we don't want to do speech. We both did not want to do speech on this game. What else could work? And Charlie Brown's teacher was brought up, which then also made me think of the orchestral work Peter and the Wolf, which has every instrument in the orchestra is a different character in the story. And it's about Peter hunting a wolf. So between those two things, it came up with the idea, we'll do voices, instruments for the voices, like Charlie Brown's teacher. Wah, 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 wah. And we'll make, and I decided I would make each character a different instrument that reflected who they were and their personality. So we tried it out with a kind of trumpety sound for Wilson and figured out that it worked. It was fun and quirky. And then I spent a couple of days sitting down with the sketches of all the characters and figuring out what instruments would go with each character and then recording all of that.
And you ended up with mostly sort of like woodwindy instruments for a lot of them?
Most of the women were flutes.
Or flutes, yeah.
Except for Wickerbottom, the old librarian, she's an oboe.
Right.
That somehow connected librarian and oboes.
Of course. And that's the kind of thing you couldn't necessarily, oh, okay, this is going to sound right. Because you can't just have something that, like you could say, okay, this person should be a drum set, but obviously you're not going to get any emotional meaning out of their audio.
Right. And that's, the emotional content is a large part of it. Because what I was able to do was I was able to play it with an electronic wind instrument called an iwi. It's like a MIDI controller that uses breath. And I'm originally a saxophone player, so I connect with that very well. So I was able to play these instruments as a very, organic, real way. That gave some of that emotion and like made them more real.
So that,
and then in some cases went the exact opposite, like, WX78, the robot, I made one note, almost Morse Cody sounding synth sound for his voice. So he just like, because it was like, that fits his character.
Right. It's a side thing obviously, but I'm a little fascinated with this electronic wind instrument. So I had never known that this could exist. But this is like a MIDI thing?
Yeah, it's a MIDI controller that is essentially like a sort of tube with keys on it laid out the way a saxophone is laid out, and you blow into it. And then that breath, there's in the MIDI spec, there is actually Continuous Controller 2 is labeled as breath. So you can use that for volumes. And then you can, it sort of has a reed-like element to it, so that if you're used to biting your reed while you play a saxophone, which can do certain things to the sound, you can do that, and that registers as a thing that is recorded. So
that's very cool.
Only saxophone players seem to know about them.
Right. But you happen to be a saxophone player, and so you were able to do the voices for this game that ended up being very successful. And you know, people were, from what I saw, critically positive of those voices. And so it worked out very well.
It's definitely one of the things that jumped out at me as an interesting sound element in the game. And I think it solves a problem that you have if you don't have voice recording, is as the soundscape gets richer, it starts to feel more and more unnatural if there isn't voice of the, like, you know, people are walking around and you hear the footsteps and the clinking and clanking and, you know, as you do anything, and then they start talking and it's just silence, right? Like it feels really unnatural. Whereas this gives that nice sense of like, oh yeah, these people are having a conversation sort of in a language I don't understand, and it's being subtitled for me instead of these people are having like a psychic conversation where there's no actual sound coming.
Well, The Sims does that, right? Like The Sims, it has an infinite budget, but they just could never possibly have all useful, interesting, reasonable conversations in between all the interactions from every Sim and every other Sim. And so even all the way back to Sims 1, like 10 or whatever years ago, they had voice acting, but nonsense voice acting, and it worked. And you just sort of tune it out as, they just speak some other language and it's okay.
Also solves your localization problems pretty handily.
the stuff that they've gone through, I toured Redwood Shores back, I think it was probably around Sims 2, and saw how their audio system worked. And it was nuts what they went into to get Simlish to work, because they were recording Simlish for like every animation in the game. So there was a massive amount of voice acting. While it wasn't English, it was just as much.
That's interesting.
It was crazy. They had specific tools for dealing with the volume of animations and audio that would go along with it in the games. And it was this really cool system that nobody else would need, probably, that it took the animations from the animators and put them into a container that all of the audio files went along with. So that kind of file container went to the recording studio, and the actors could see the animations, and what they recorded was put into this content, this folder thing. It wasn't a folder, it was a container. Like, so you just passed around one file. That went to the editors, and then that went to the implementers. So it was a way of like organizing this massive amount of data that they had to handle that I don't think anybody else would need, but was really cool for what they were doing.
That's a detail that people would often overlook. Like, you can easily imagine having more than 20 or 30 sounds called sound1.wav and animation1.anim or whatever, like pretty quickly. It's just like, wait, which sound? Okay, here's you emailing around or whatever, putting on a Dropbox this new sound. And you're like, what does it go with? Or that's going to cause a lot of horrible problems.
Naming structure is a big thing that goes on in sound for games that people may be overlooking, especially if you're doing your own games on an indie level. Make sure that every file name means something in your sounds, because, you know, sound1.wave or sound1final.wave is like a kiss of death.
Final 2014.
Sound1 _final_final_final, which I've seen more than a few of, even at the AAA.
Yeah, I've seen some horror. I've seen like final, real final version 5. You know, you're like, that's gets into a real messy territory. So have a good file name, especially if you are going to do speech, make sure those file names mean something.
That makes a lot of sense. Have you guys played Papers, Please?
Yes.
No, I haven't played it yet.
So it has a... Yeah, you should sound dejected. You should play it. It's because it's short and quirky and interesting. But the voices in that one, I thought, were a very good update of the sort of old... Like, if you go to NES days, even, when there was dialogue, you know, and Punch-Out and stuff, and when they would say this long piece of speech, but the, you know, the audio equivalent would be... Meh, meh, meh. But it would still successfully, like with that, you could tell kind of the tone that the person was having, and it felt better than sort of the next generation often had no audio at all, which was sort of weird. Like, there's this gap. As soon as there started to be speech, there started to be either you have full recorded voice acting or you have complete silence. And I like that sort of Papers, Please, Don't Starve, Punch Out thing of actually having some sort of sound for, you know, when the speech is happening. So we'll change gears a little bit. Actually, yeah. I'll do a sponsor read and then we'll change gears a little bit.
Sounds good.
So this episode is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. Steam Clock makes wonderful apps for iOS, Android, and the web. If you're a Fortune 500, a startup, or somewhere in between, and you're looking to work with a team that sweats every pixel, learn more at www.steamclock.com. So it's harder than ever for indie games to stick out nowadays. The amazing tools and great things like Steam and all of the various app stores and things have made it a lot easier and a lot more commercially viable to get into making a game. But of course, it's challenging for you to produce great 3D worlds. Even if people are good at what they do, it's incredibly time consuming. And so I've seen one trend that I've seen over, I guess, the last 2 or 3 years, but maybe even longer, is that some of the games that really stick out as just kind of great games have put a outsized portion of the total effort into them, into the sound design. You look at a game like Bastion that has this incredible narration, which, you know, gets into this, you know, doing the voice acting, which we said was challenging, but they have one narrator and they've put, like, I don't know, some huge percentage of their budget into narration.
The interesting thing, I'll just...
Yeah, please.
Bastion will always make me interrupt somebody to talk about Bastion.
Please do.
They had next to no budget. What they had was time. They spent a really long period of time recording every possible dialogue. He recorded that with the voice actor in his closet.
Huh.
You know, they didn't have a large budget. They had his friend and they had time.
So did he just happen to have a friend who he was like, you know, you have a really awesome voice. I'd like to record it. Or is his friend happened to be a professional voice actor and was doing a favor?
No, I could be wrong, but I think that was his first gig. So he had a friend who was an actor who just had a good voice.
That's awesome.
So on an indie level, just be aware of everything that's in your vicinity and what you might be able to take advantage of. Don't take advantage of them. That's a whole thing, but use everything at your disposal. It's like the Robert Rodriguez when he did El Mariachi, for next to no money. Anything he get its hands on, he wrote into the script. So it was like that somebody could lend him a bus. So he's like, all right, I'll write a bus into the script because I can use that and that's worth something. You know, so be aware of if you've got a friend with a good voice, keep that in the back of your head. And if I do a game with voice, maybe I can get my friend with a good voice to be in it.
Yeah. That's a particularly neat trick if you have a game where it's dependent on the narration, because then kind of all you need is one good voice actor. We were talking a couple weeks ago about Stanley Parable, right? Which has kind of the same structure.
Totally. If that hadn't have been a good voice actor, if that had a good voice, it would have been dead in the water.
But you basically only need the one guy. And, you know, we talked earlier about the cost involved and if we've got all these voice actors and we got to get them in and if we got to be re-recording all the time, well, you can't get a whole crew together that's going to all be top-notch voice actors that are willing to do that. But maybe you can find one guy, the one guy who, like you said, is an actor and just happens to be a really good voice actor and is willing to say, yeah, I'll commit to coming in, one day a week for the next 6 months to do this. And, and then you can... then you can make something like that work, but that really only works if you've got narration, right? As soon as you've got multiple characters talking to each other, then the chances of you finding enough people that are awesome to fill all those roles and that are all able to come in often enough to make it work, it basically drops to zero almost instantly. But there's a local maximum sweet spot kind of thing there of if you can do it all with narration, maybe you can make it work.
I'm still reeling from the idea that this Bastion guy with the amazing voice is recording in the game developer's closet.
Proper story is supposed to start at the beginning. Ain't so simple with this one.
It's just so cool.
Yeah. Your closet with all the clothes in it is actually a really good spot if you don't have a good treated room.
I've recorded multiple episodes of Up, Up, Down, Down in my closet.
Yeah, I was recording in the closet for the first couple episodes as well.
But when I do it, I think like, oh man, this is just so... I don't think of it as cool indie. I think of it as like, you know, I don't know. I definitely don't think of really high-end stuff as having, or at least, you know, very successful things that turn out really well as being recorded that way. So it makes me feel good.
I've also heard multiple stories from like voice actors or people that record like audiobooks and stuff like that. If they have to record something when they're on the road, that in a hotel, that's a great, you got a hotel room, you know, probably it's going to be too noisy out in the main room and not going to have good sound isolation, but the closet is a pretty good place for that. So I've heard stories at least two or three times. There was a thing on This American Life a couple of weeks back about someone getting locked in a closet when they were like doing a voice recording gig. And that's not the first time I've heard of people having to do sudden like emergency voice recording sessions in closets.
Yeah, well, a large part of it is because if you hang a lot of clothes in it, it's very dead. And if you can't have a good live sounding room, a dead room is better. A bad live sounding room is a kiss of death.
It's very hard to fix.
Yeah. Whereas a dead, you can make it more live again, but you can't. It's really hard to de-live a bad sound.
Yeah. I was at XOXO this past weekend and talking to Jason Snell, who works on the podcast The Incomparable, who has like often five or six guests all in various audio backgrounds. And so I sort of mentioned to him, like, how do you get it all sounding that even? And he's like, I have a secret plugin. It's not secret. It's called Sound Soap. So I'm very excited. Next time we have someone with the, you know, maybe I'm not sure how much it's going to help for echoiness, but especially if there's like a fans and things, then
there is these amazing new plugins that have come out in about the past year. The best of them is called Unveil, and it gets rid of reverb.
Ah.
It's magic. RX Advanced has it in it as well. And there's a company called Akon, I believe they're called, that has Deverberator. They're all these new wave of deverberation plugins that 5 years ago didn't exist. It's magic, basically. So RX is definitely the best cleanup tool. If you need to clean up audio, RX is the best one.
RX. All right. I'll keep that down. RX.
And it actually has a function called, I can't remember if it's vocal denoise or speech denoise, but it's optimized to get rid of noise around speech.
That's awesome. Now I'm like Googling around. I want to buy all these plugins now. Cool. So that's a good transition into sort of the editing side of things. I guess you know, I've been using Logic for editing the podcast, but I assume you use Pro Tools because that has Pro in the name, so it's got to be the most...
Well, the Taurus, yeah. Totally. That's the only reason.
Isn't Logic technically Logic Pro as well?
Yeah, I believe... I don't know if they've dropped the Pro to just Logic, but I believe it's Logic Pro.
Yeah.
Logic is really... they're all really great. There's a million great tools. I've been talking about this lately on Twitter with a bunch of audio guys. You really can just use what you want. There's so many great tools. I feel like people use Pro Tools who have been around a while because everybody else uses it. And if you need to interface with other engineers, you can pass off Pro Tools projects. That's about one of the only real reasons to use Pro Tools. I have a certain workflow that works best in Pro Tools for me, but you can use Pro Tools. You can use Logic. Tons of composers use Logic more than anything. There's Logic. There's Reaper, which is a more of an indie-based DAW, digital audio workstation, which is phenomenal and really cheap. There's Nuendo and Cubase from Steinberg. Nuendo is kind of their more one that's focused on post-production and does some of that workflow better. But there's so many great tools out there that it doesn't matter. When people are like, what should I get? I'm like, get whatever you want and just learn it really well. You know, the end result is you're going to deliver a sound to a client if you're a freelancer. You're not going to deliver... here's the session I did things in. They don't care about that. They care about a really cool, you know, rocket sound. So use whatever you want to make that. You know, use Audacity if you're comfortable in that.
Okay, well, just...
don't use Audacity. Don't do that.
I keep trying to get rid of Audacity, and then whenever I delete it, I find some reason that I need to use it because it's the only one that can do what I need to do.
And that's like converting a file or doing some sort of...
Audacity can open stuff that nothing else can. It's amazing.
Or real media files or something.
If you've got some damaged file with like the headers all screwed or something, Audacity will still open it up and then you can spit it out into, you know, a nice fixed form. So it's a really great tool and it's free. So...
So speaking of tools, another one that was sort of interesting to me, and I've been poking around exploring what options there are sound libraries. I was on this one Hollywood Gold or something. It was like basically sound libraries for every single sound you could ever want. They'll send you a terabyte hard drive filled with 100,000 various car horn sounds. How important that is that when you're doing an indie game? Are you able to find useful canned or pre-made sounds for a lot of things you would in a fantasy world want to play?
There's the big generic libraries used to be the only way to go. There's Hollywood Edge and there's Sound Ideas and there's a couple others. There's Blastwave and there's a couple other companies that do that. In the last couple of years, there's been a real rise of like small indie boutique sound library people that have very specific libraries for very certain things. Like I have a Swish library that's just a million whooshes recorded really well and really nicely. So when I need to do whooshes, I go to that library. So I think if you're a independent sound designer, you need at least a couple generic libraries to fill in all the gaps, and then you start getting the specific ones when you need them. If you're a game designer who's doing your own sounds, there's a couple of sites that allow you to buy sounds a la carte from all of those libraries. I would advise doing that because you're going to know what you need. You don't need 10 million car horns. But if you're a sound designer, maybe you need that car horn for that game and another car horn for another game. So like you're going to find use in those libraries.
Unfortunately, I mean, car horns, I imagine it's easier to find, and from looking through the things, it's easier to find things that really exist. Shock. Rather than some fantastical animal.
Well, that's the thing. Anytime you're making a sound, you never, or very rarely, you want to take a sound straight out of a library and drop it into your game. That's lazy. That's going to make your game sound just like every other game. And it's like, are you buying generic art that you're just dropping in, then maybe buying the sounds and dropping in is fine. But any sound designer is taking sounds and layering them together. And so any sound I make is probably 4 to 12 sounds within it that make up that thing. Unless I need something very specific, like this is a 78 Charger car horn. Well, I'm going to get that sound.
So that's a lot of sounds combined together. Can you get like an example of, I mean, I guess everyone knows the Jurassic Park example of making a dinosaur roar is like a lion and a whale and a cheetah and a...
Yeah. Okay. It's only two sounds, but the bees in Don't Starve. Those are a combination of a beehive that I found and recorded. So I had individual bees themselves buzzing. And then I played a kazoo and buzzed through that because I didn't want just bees. I wanted a humanization of those bees.
Right.
So I was able to play some emotion into it through the kazoo. So that way that became the bees in the game, which pant when they land on the ground because they're tired and because they're big and fat.
Yeah, now that you say that, especially the panting when they're on the ground, it is kazoo-ish. But I hadn't thought about that. It's just like, it's not a normal bee. It's a Don't Starve World bee, and it has that certain feel that the rest of the game has.
Which is great for, everything in that game is kind of quirky. So, doing stuff like that, that works. But if you ever have a chance, there's a couple of videos out there of gun recordings and guns recorded from different spots that play individually. This mic was in front, this mic was in back, this mic was, 20 feet away, this mic was 60 feet away. And then this is all of those mics combined. Any gun you hear in a game is a mixture of probably 4 or 5 different mic locations to capture different aspects of that gun. To give it that over-the-top big video game Hollywood feel.
Yeah, gun sounds in games, especially movies too, are not being very familiar with guns as a Canadian, where you don't have a lot of guns going off around, but my understanding is that they're fairly ridiculous compared to what a gun would actually sound like in real life.
Yeah, I lived in the States for a couple of years, and in that time did actually fire guns once. And
as you're required to.
Yeah, as you're legally required to. No, it was just I had a friend whose dad was a gun guy, and so he took us shooting once. But yeah, it's actually surprising how little real guns sound like guns if you've grown up on movies and video games. Real guns sound like little, like, pop guns, sound like cap guns or something like that compared to what you're used to in what they do with sound design and in films and video games and everything.
Yeah. And especially in video games, I think more than movies, like a first person shooter, we're after that feel of you shooting a gun. Now, if you hear a gunshot, it sounds like a little pop. But if you shoot a gun, it's next to your head and blowing up. Like, it's really loud and it's physical. Like, you know, the gun kicks into your body. And we're trying to get that with having no physical aspect to it in a game. So that's why one of the reasons it becomes make it over the top and huge, because, you know, that's what you're trying to replicate.
Yeah, you need to make it sound like the recoil, because, again, you don't have that haptic feedback to feel the recoil. Like, they feel scary. They don't sound scary, but they feel really scary. Like, that, even a little, like, .22 pistol, which was what I was firing, has a tremendous amount of kickback compared to what you expect.
And that spills over into just about a lot of sounds in games. We're trying to add the physical aspect through the sound. So you kind of got to go over the top to do that.
It's also for fun, right? It's a game, so you want to err on the side of fun. Even if bees do not sound like kazoos, it's definitely more fun when they do. So another, I guess two last things from my list. One is you got to go on location when you were doing your Don't Starve sounds.
That's something as a sound designer in the indie field you don't get to do very often. You know, it's much lower budgets, unlike a AAA thing where you're like, I'm doing a race of games, so I'm going to record a whole bunch of cars down in California. I'm going to record a whole bunch of guns for my first-person shooter. We don't have those sorts of budgets, but I did manage to go record in a mine. We were adding caves into Don't Starve, and I had reached the end of all my sample libraries of what I had for stuff in a cave and needed more source, which, if you're a sound designer, you should always be recording and build your own library of sounds as you go. The longer you do it, the bigger that library gets, and the more you use those instead of the same stuff everybody else is using. So I started looking around for caves in the Vancouver area, and there's nothing. There's nothing. Like, you have to go to the Rockies before you start getting caves. They didn't form here. But we do have a mining museum about an hour and a half outside of town that runs tours through part of the mine. So I contacted them, Britannia Mining Museum, and they were like, yeah, we get people from, you know, the movies and TV here recording all the time. So they were kind of already set up to let people escorted, but let them run amok in their tunnels. So I was able to, I took a bunch of recording stuff, took a pile of things I wanted to make sounds in a mine with, and spent 2 hours
banging things together,
getting dusty and firing off cap guns and hitting cymbals and making strange noises in a cave.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I guess in my sort of imagination in games, especially indie games, most of the sounds are a dry sound that's just been recorded in a closet with clothes or what have you. They add the "this makes it sound like a cave" effect, or "this makes it sound like a prairie" effect.
There's an interesting reverb plugin type called convolution reverb that takes a impulse response from a space and applies it to whatever you're feeding through it. And that's a way of making something like sound like this came from this. So when we were in the caves, we recorded impulses as well. So if there was anything I didn't record in the cave that needed to sound cavey, we had an impulse as well that we could kind of like fake it after the fact, but was a better faking it than what was already available to me.
I guess do they have like libraries where you can buy those convolution kernels, basically?
Yeah.
And you can buy the essence of this cave and the essence of this cave, and for only $50.
They're mostly aimed at music, so it's like this big recording call and that big recording call. But there is some that kind of have a post-production section to them that are like, here's a tiled bathroom, and here's a long hallway, and here's an office building. And
right, but so. You want like the demon cave of Hellspawn from the giant volcano convolution or something. You
know? Yeah, and I also wanted, if I'm going to add to what I had already recorded, I wanted it all to sound like it came from the same cave. Right. So I had that.
Awesome. And then the final thing was everyone's favorite sound from Don't Starve, or at least one of the most the most distinctive ones was the gobbler.
Yes.
So this is a turkey-like creature. Which in the playing of the game, it just hadn't occurred to me that, of course, that had to be a human being making that sound. But I guess they were fairly lucky that you have enough voice acting experience / talent that when you needed a gobbler.
Another area of voice acting. You can be a really great voice actor, and then you can be and a really great creature voice actor. And they're two different things. Not every voice actor can be a creature voice actor. I am lucky enough to be a decent creature voice actor more than I am a regular voice actor. My regular voice acting is I'm a guard, and that's it. That's my range. When we were designing the gobbler creature, I was collecting a la carte turkey sounds because I didn't have any in my libraries. That's the thing with libraries. You always find holes in them. So I was buying a bunch of turkey sounds, and then I was looking at the animations, and I just made that sound. And it was just like, I don't know, stroke of madness or genius, whatever you want to call it. I was like, that's it. I'm actually the turkey.
And then you were.
Yes. And then I got banned in the office from making that sound ever again.
That's not very surprising. But
yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show, Matt. How can people find more about you and what you do?
You can find me on Twitter at Mattesque, MATTESQUE. I frequent that most of all. I'm also on ask.fm. Yeah. I answer questions there all the time. I also do a podcast about indie game audio with another sound designer here in town, Gord McLadry. Called Beards, Cats, and Indie Game Audio, which is in all the usual podcast spots. Those are generally the main ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, I'll put a link to your podcast and Twitter, of course, in the show notes. Cool. Thanks to everyone for listening. We always want to know what you think. So please send us some feedback. Let us know. Do we suck? Are we awesome? Somewhere in between. Send us email, hello@upup.fm, or leave us a review on the iTunes store. And see you next week.
I've been playing Destiny.
Destiny.
I'm one of those. Yeah,
that's good. That gives us an excuse to talk about Destiny.
The most un-indie game ever.
It is actually, if you measure it by, you know, most accounts, the least indie game ever made.
Yeah.
How's that?
It's fun. It's not the second coming of gamedom or anything. I think Polygon's review of a 6 is probably not that far off. I think it's probably more like a 7, but I'm still having fun and I keep going back and playing it. There's a lot of flaws, but it's still a fun at what it does. You know, when I played the beta and was telling people like, do you like the last Halo Bungie games? Then you'll like this. If you didn't, you won't like it. It's, you know, it's just what they do.
It was interesting to read the reviews, and I was waiting for the Polygon one in particular. And saw that they actually two different people review the game and give it effectively the same take, which is there's some really great things and some fairly lame things all churned up into a giant extravaganza. And so it's interesting. Like, no one has said, like, oh, it's boring. There's nothing. Like, it's just yet another shooter. It doesn't suffer from that. It seems to suffer from, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen and other problems like that instead, which is at least more interesting.
The story is bad and confusing. The world looks beautiful. You know, PvP is fun, but the quests along the storyline are the same thing over and over again, and those kind of are boring-ish. So yeah, it's definitely a mixed bag. It'll be interesting to see where they go with it, with the DLCs and the theory that's popping around that you are the bad guy is interesting. I think that's an interesting thing that the fans have sort of made up, even if it's not true.
That's never a good sign when the fans are like trying to come up with stuff to make the story not lame. Like,
well, when in the lame category for the game, the huge amount of the story is in like these cards you unlock that you have to go to their website to see. Like, why aren't those in the game? Like, the majority of people are going to be like, oh, that's a thing. I'm not going to go do that because it's, I have to go on my computer and look something up. It's like, don't disconnect the fans from your backstory stuff. And there's a ton of backstory in there.
That sounds like a marketing publishing tie-in thing that was forced upon someone.
Possibly. And that's the thing with like, we don't know what happened or how these things came about. Like the Peter Dinklage bad voice acting. We don't know where that broke in the chain because there's so many people involved in making those decisions.
So this is something that I found really fascinating because for anyone who has not, we mentioned this like every other show, but Destiny is the game with the highest budget of all time, $500 million spent making this game. And when you get to that point, you have economic forces of, you know, the publisher Activision, who has been known for making business decisions that didn't always result in the most pure gaming experiences. And so you, at that scale, you know, as you need more and more money, they're going to be able to extract more and more concessions. And yeah, also, most likely, there's producers and business people who have to calculate, like, okay, how could we possibly make, you know, put in 500 million, because if you put in 500 million and you get 500 million out, that's still enough for your like game. Like your game will never get a sequel. That's for sure.
Yeah.
It needs to be profitable. And like Activision's profit margins are like 50%. So unless it makes 750 million, then it's still going to bring their profits down.
Yeah.
So my cynical side, and not having played the game yet, I will probably be playing it in the next couple of weeks. The cynical side of me sees weird things like Peter Dinklage bad voice acting and thinks like, okay, what kind of cynical business motivations? Well, maybe he was really, you know, at the height of his fame from Game of Thrones at the moment they were doing the voice acting. So they said, okay, can we get you in? He's like, yeah, but I can only give you 2 weeks. And they're like, okay, we'll take you for 2 weeks. And then just rolled with it, you know?
Totally. There's so many. With him, it's not every actor is a good voice actor. So maybe it's that. He's a great actor, but maybe he's just not a good voice actor. Maybe he wasn't given enough direction. Like the beginning of the game, I've noticed this. He sounds like he doesn't know what he's talking about in the beginning. And it's like nobody told him, hey, this is what, you know, this is what's going on. About halfway through, it feels like it's gotten a little better. And it seems like he's like read the script through. And he's like, oh, I know what I'm talking about now because I talked about this before. I'm kind of getting some clues on what's going on.
That's horrible.
You know, so it could be bad voice direction. It could be a bad producer who went, no, I want to use these lines. Because I've heard stories of like in Splinter Cell, there's a Splinter Cell that's held up as one of the worst voice acting for barks in a game. All the guards say Sam Fisher's name like a million times. And apparently the story that's come out is a producer right like the day before ship increased the amount of speech that would happen, like screwed with the mix of stuff and with no intervention from any of the sound team, and it shipped. And they were like, wait a minute, we didn't want that. And the producer was like, oh, it's great. You know, they talk all the time now. And it turned out to be horrible. So there's so many people that are involved in that chain of on that level of getting a voice like that in, that's like, who knows where the problems happened.
The ambient sort of things that guards and villagers and things say, one of my pet peeves is something that's really, and I guess maybe this is a general thing, if you have a line that is really interesting or quirky, that's good the first time you hear it, but gets exponentially worse. So if the guard just says like, and that's their whole line, then you repeat that pretty frequently, then it's not that bad. But if they're like, man, I'd really love a ham and cheese sandwich right now, then maybe the first time it's funny, and then the second time you're like, really? And the third time you're like, okay.
I took an arrow to the knee?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you definitely have to, if you're doing barks, you need a large variety pool to pull from, especially if it's actual words. Our brain is just so hardwired to pick out speech more than any other sound. You know, it's like a survival thing. So, yeah, you got to be really careful with your variety. Get lots of it.
Randomizing it like the footsteps doesn't work.
Yeah, and you have to weight it so that you're like, okay, I've got a bunch of just generic grunts and then one awesome line. Okay, I'll scale down to the awesome line only plays 5% of the time, or, you know, whatever it is, so that it doesn't happen all the time and you're playing just the regular grunts more often than that.
The other thing that my cynical mind for explanations comes up into with Destiny that I've been reading is this change from sort of a twitchy style where the enemies have low hit points, but you have to like sort of hit them in specific ways, or so it being more moving around the space, into more of a bullet sponge type setup where you will be running around shooting and hitting this boss for 20 minutes, 30 yeah. minutes, which seems to me as like, okay, if this is going to be a game that sells this many copies, it needs to be more MMO-like. How is it going to be MMO-like? Well, if it's going to be MMO-like, there needs to be a team of people who are all fighting a thing. It's like, well, if it's a team of people all fighting a thing, you can't have just one guy headshot it and it dies.
Yeah.
It needs to be a bullet sponge, pretty much. And so that's what you get, like, sort of the MMO genre tends to be full of either bullet sponges or spell sponges or sword sponges.
Yeah, there's definitely, it's not a perfect game. I'm enjoying playing it, but it's not perfect by any stretch.
It's kind of the way I felt about a lot of the previous Bungie games. Like, I never entirely understood why Halo was so beloved. Like, it, you know, there were lots of things about it that bugged me. And it's, like, it's a good game. I enjoyed it. I played played a couple of the sequels, not all of them. But, you know, there's certainly things of, like, the story takes itself a little more seriously than it deserves, and the, like, epic music is way more epic than the things it's underscoring, and, you know, the fact that I've walked through this same room, like, 15 times in the course of going through this level, it's starting to get a little and, like, you know, all the problems with Destiny seem to be kind of outgrowths of the problems with that always seemed to me were there with Halo. And I think with Halo, it was just one of those things of there was something, you know, zeitgeisty about it, that it even though it had those problems, it appealed to people anyways and got really successful and then became the juggernaut. But there wasn't there wasn't actually an amazing foundation there. And so when they start over and try the same tricks with an IP that isn't already beloved, people just aren't connecting to it the same way.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing. I was talking with a guy at work. There's no audio options in Destiny. You can't adjust music or sound effects at all. It's just, it is the volume it is. So he was playing and he's like, oh, I'm feeling epic. And he's like, I'm actually just feeling epic because the epic music is playing. I'd like to turn that off. And he's like, I can't.
Womp womp.
So they're making you always feel that way. Like, they're making those epic moves. Like, music can really drive you to feel a certain way. So they're not letting you turn off those things because they're like, no, we have to use the music to make you feel epic at this moment. Even if you, because if you probably played it without it, you'd be like, all right, it's just a big dude that's a bullet sponge.
Yeah, but unfortunately, sometimes you're in a circumstance where you need to be able to hear certain things, like feedback in the game, for it to be playable, but it needs to be quieter, so you need audio options.
Yeah, as someone who plays, like, a lot of the games that I play at night after the kids and my wife are in bed, and, like, I've got to be very conscious about how much noise I'm making. Like, I'm almost always going in and, like, dialing down the music volume and push the voice volume up a little bit, or, like, take the voice volume way down and just turn subtitles on, or, like, tweaking the audio environment to try and get something where I can get, like, 70% of the sound experience without waking anyone else up.
Yeah. I found my solution for that, because I'm in a similar situation. I don't want to wake my girlfriend up, is I use gamer headphones. And I've actually been quite impressed with, like, the Astro stuff. Sounds good and lets me turn it up loud, but not for anybody else.
Are these the headphones you can plug into the PS4 controller, or is this just like a long cable from your TV?
No, the Astro headphones have a special mix box that does faked Dolby surround for your headphones. So they're way better than that.
Nice.
Yeah, they're good. I was surprised.
Are you able to, shifting gears, are you able to talk about what you're working on right now?
Right now, we're mostly working on Invisible Ink.
Invisible Ink? Oh, I've been hearing good things about Invisible Ink.
Yeah, it's our turn-based spy game.
Yeah, so...
Tactical stealth, I think, is part of our tagline.
For anyone listening, Invisible Ink, ink is like incorporated. So that's the joke. It's not like...
Yes.
secret writing.
Yes. The pun plays out in the writing, not in the saying.
Yeah. Yeah, but it looks cool. So it's in Steam Early Access recently? Is that the, is
yes.
the current state of affairs?
Yeah, and we're doing 2-week updates on it, so...
Awesome. So it's turn-based, stealthy. Is there anything more kind of interesting about it that you want to say at this point? I mean, it's public, so you can say whatever you want. But.
Yeah, I totally can. It's turning into a really great game. It's procedurally generated levels. It's permadeath for the players, so it's hard. We actually had to. It was too hard, so we had to put in an easy mode for everyone.
That's what early access is for: is releasing a game that's too hard and then making it easier until people stop crying.
Yeah. there still is that really hard mode in there as well. So if you want to challenge, it's there. It's turning out really good. It's an interesting challenge as a sound person. It's the first time I've done a turn-based game. And sound during turn-based can be a little different because you have to account for the fact that somebody can sit and stare at a screen for 10 minutes with nothing going on while they just contemplate what their next move is. And that still has to sound interesting.
And that's mostly the music, or is there sort of ambient world noises that just happen every once in a while, even though, because the sense of time is sort of abstract at that point, so maybe...
Yeah, we're doing it with much longer music. It's not short loops. It's like much longer songs, so that's more interesting. And then I'm built a lot of ambient building of the world so that there's stuff going on while still balancing what the player needs to be informed about, what's the things they're actually, need to hear.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to play it.
Yeah, it's turning out really great.
Cool. Well, I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.